Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Ira Harris, Ronald Peter Stovall, and Jayant Bhandari. Ira is an independent trader, successful hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003. Ronald is a managing partner and investment manager at Incrementum. Together with Mark Balick, he manages a global macro fund, which is based on the principles of the Austrian School of Economics. And he's also the co-author on the In Gold We Trust report, of which he'll be discussing as well. Jayant is constantly traveling the world looking for investment opportunities, particularly in the natural resource sector. He advises institutional investors about his finds. Earlier, he worked for 6 years with U.S. Global Investors, a boutique natural resource investment firm, and for 1 year with Casey Research. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to be with you.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Richard. Nice to be on with everybody.
Great. So I thought today we'd begin with Ira's recent blog post where he makes an analogy between Ben Bernanke, the former Fed chairman, and Karl Marx. And he actually has a very unique ability to connect the dots between that, statements by Janet Yellen, and what the yield curve may be telling us, as well as the price of gold. Ira, do you want to discuss that?
Well, yeah, you know, Richard, it's as I was read Bernanke's speech from from Portugal that he gave the other day. I had to pull off my shelf, and it was sitting right next to me. Marx's writings, probably to me, is some of his best, probably his best work. I know people would argue, Marx's scholars would argue, but the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts of 1844, because Bernanke's, well, I won't say whole, but certainly a big theme in his speech was, of course, the rise of populism, and he speaks, he uses words, he calls it a sour mood, he calls it this and that, but it seems so much in line with Marx of 1844, with talking about alienation and estrangement, and this was what was leading to the politics. So that's why I looked at it in that regard, and then I went to the chapter on, he talks about wages, and you have it in front of you, I don't have it in front of me, Richard, or you have it, you know, where he talks about that, you know, labor and capital are always in conflict, and the one thing you can be certain of is that when profits fall, labor will certainly be affected negatively. But yet Bernanke, you know, wants to take another bite of it and talks about how this is a real problem. And, you know, as I've written many for the last few years with Janet Yellen, I have no problem with her as a moral philosopher. Adam Smith, after all, was more a moral philosopher than he ever was an economist. And so she can have those opinions, as you know, about labor and wages, but I don't really want that in my Fed chairman. I want somebody who's hard money, and or let me say the better, sound money, so I don't sound like the Bundesbank of the 70s and 80s and 90s. So I just drew those conclusions, but I thought his speech paints the Fed into a corner, and that was my point, and that maybe that's, you know, that the fact that wages are so stagnant, why is Janet Yellen now going to move? Why are they so concerned about the possibility of wage inflation as being their raising rates when they've been so stagnant? So you're going to kick the American worker and workers all over the world, because we saw that even Draghi picked up on that theme, as well as, you know, it's ongoing in Japan too, and even Mark Carney. So this now is the theme, but yet they're in a hurry to start tightening, which, you know, in my opinion, it should have done years ago. But now that wages have certainly not picked up, and it's only asset values that have really increased. So that was the purpose of it, because now I want to see how I can find trades. And you know what, maybe it's time to buy gold, because again, you know, gold hasn't been an inflationary story. You know, this has been a theme of mine for many years. It's more of a deflation story. And if wages are sticky down, as we know that they are, how are the central banks going to combat them? And that's kind of where I left it at.
Interesting. Your thoughts, Ronnie, on that, especially as it relates to the link to gold. You've recently written the In Gold We Trust report. If you can elaborate, that'd be great.
I could answer for an hour probably, because Ira raised so many interesting points. I think from my point of view, populism, and we wrote a chapter about that in the report, it's all a consequence of the economy. So it's just a symptom, and just one very, very disturbing number. It's actually out of a McKinsey study. It shows that in the last decade, 70% of all households in developed countries, in industrialized countries, had stagnating or even declining household incomes. So I think it's no wonder that populism is coming up, because people are actually not doing very well. So of course they vote for change and not for the status quo. And that's the same in the US. That's the same in with the Brexit and all over Europe. So I think that the populism coming up, it's only a consequence of the economic mess that we're in. And if you know history, it has always been like that. And that, of course, makes me very, very worried. Now, when it comes to the Fed, I would say that they are quite desperate, because they've lost such an enormous amount of credibility over the last couple of years. And now they kind of want to appear very hawkish. We all know that the Fed is tightening into weakness, actually. Another major point that we're making in the report is we're seeing massive recession threats coming in. We're seeing, tax receipts are very weak. Industrial production is weak. Credit growth, which is very, very important, is actually collapsing. We're seeing so many economic numbers just getting weaker and weaker. And therefore, from my point of view, the Fed sooner or later will have to make a U-turn. And this is exactly going to be the point when gold will pick up momentum, and when gold will rise, I don't know, 5-10% within a matter of a few weeks or even days.
And Jayant, your thoughts on that?
Well, I completely agree with both what Ira and Ronald said. I would just restructure the way things have progressed slightly differently. I think we are in an advanced stage of democracy around the world. Democracy automatically leads to populism and overregulation. And the reason is that the masses don't really understand the devastation that overregulations and populism lead us to. And this has led to death of growth in the economy. Overregulations and populism means that we have too many regulations imposed on the businesses, and populism means that they are taxed to death if you are doing any business. And the result is decay in economic growth.
Ira, is this some kind of signal that is being given by the yield curves, as you see, like the 2-10s, or what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, and I, again, we talked, I think the last time I was on, Richard, we talked about the yield curves, of course, are a difficult signal because of the destruction of the signaling mechanism of debt markets. You know, which used to be very good sovereign debt markets. You know, we had a sense of when inflation was really, the market was worried about inflation, because we'd see the long end of the curve actually, you know, yields would go up no matter what the Fed did, because, of course, when the bond, quote-unquote, vigilantes are allowed to work, real yields are the normative measure. So when you go negative because inflation is on the rise and central banks are reticent to raise rates, we know what happens. Now we just don't know, and yet we see what is going on in the markets. The fact that the 210, you know, I always break the yield curves out differently because I look at the 210 as more of an investor's curve, insurance companies, pension funds, much more involved, where I use the 530 as a sense of what the speculative community is more enamored with. And both of those have been flattening in sync. That hadn't been true up until about 3 or 4 months ago. One was going one way and the other was kind of stagnating. Now they've both flattened. Of course, we're down into some, as when I put on my trader hat, we're down to some significant levels of support. But I, you know, and everybody's scratching their head, why are these curves flattening? Why are these curves flattening? You know, the Fed's raising rates, which most people don't understand. The Fed can be raising rates, but it has more effect on the short-term rates, meaning probably two years than it does on anything beyond that. So, it would traditionally mean that the Fed would be wrong for tightening here. That is who I think Ron talked about it, that they were tightening into a significant slowdown, which is typically the case. They're always late, historically late to the party. But this time we just don't know. And of course, because money is fungible, everybody's making a big deal about what Draghi said yesterday. I read that speech 3 times by 4 o'clock in the morning because unfortunately I happened to be up because I was watching European bond markets for other reasons. And I said, to me, I didn't sense that there was any hawkishness in that at all. And the ECB is still going to be buying $60 billion a month through December. And we know the Japanese are still, you know, okay, Kuroda may step back a little here and there, but it's $80 billion. That's a phenomenon. It's $140 billion, not counting what the Swiss are doing at any one time. And now, okay, we have Carney, who did a volta face so fast. Monday, he was very dovish. Tuesday, Andy Haldane took him to the woodshed. Now, this is the guy who's the governor of the MPC. And today he did, he totally reversed himself. So if you don't think these central banks are to be called into question, I would leave it there. And traditionally, I would say, wow, we're really going to slow down based on the yield curve. But again, because money is fungible and it's allowed to float freely around the world, I just don't know.
And Ronnie, do you see the effects of this, as you were mentioning earlier, in terms of a flattening yield curve between the 2 and the 10 as indicative of a slowdown in the economy, perhaps in the U.S. or perhaps globally? And what are you seeing in Europe overall?
Yeah, I've tweeted it this morning that the yield curve in China actually is flattening significantly as well, which I find pretty interesting. So we are having a close look at the yield curve, and it basically confirms our view. And don't get me wrong, from my point of view, a recession is something just normal. I'm not scared of a recession. It's just a normal cleansing process within a cycle, and afterwards the economy will be on a more solid base. However, we all know what central bankers and politicians will do as soon as the bad R word, recession, comes up. There will be actions by central banks. Of course, there's a significant declining marginal utility. So the next round of QE, I think $85 billion in the U.S. Will not be sufficient. It will have to be more. They will talk about negative rates. We are having plenty of discussions regarding raising the inflation targets. So I think the central bankers, they are not out of ammunition yet, but it has to become more extreme. And over here in Europe, I would say that I think the market realizes that the Federal Reserve will have to stop the rate hike cycle sooner or later, and that on the other hand, the ECB will have to become at least slightly more hawkish. And what I see is that the Germans are positioning Jens Weidmann. There is enormous pressure on the on the ECB, especially from Germany, as real estate prices go nuts, as the whole asset price inflation is something that the Germans are getting very worried. So I would say at the beginning of the year we said we are very bullish on the euro, not on a long term view, but on a from a tactical point of view. And I think having a look at the dollar index, I think this looks really weak. And we actually wrote a big chapter on Donald Trump and his team. And I think if Trump really wants to succeed with his reindustrialization of the U.S. economy, he needs a weak dollar, and he often said that the dollar is way too strong and that he wants to weaken the dollar. And at the moment, it seems that the bull market in the US dollar is over for now. Which would, of course, on the other hand, be a pretty positive environment for gold and commodities, of course.
Yeah. The thoughts on that, Ira, in terms of currencies, like where the US dollar maybe heading in gold prices?
That was who was speaking? Ronnie was speaking, right? On that whole issue, or I'm sorry.
Yes, yeah, that was Ronnie. Who, yep.
Okay, Ronnie, I too have blogged about the same thing, and I go back. I'm 100% agreement with you. When they when Trump was having those conferences, and Mark Fields, who was then the CEO of Ford, right after he comes out of the conference, and he said very openly, currency manipulation is the mother of all trade barriers. And I said, do you not understand that? And believe me, that's Trump's view, and that's Wilbur Ross's view. He understands the ability of weak currency. Yeah. So I'm in 100% agreement with that. I think, and people right now, I think, are really coming into month-end, quarter-end for hedge fund managers, money managers, have really gotten the dollar wrong. Because, first of all, you knew that the dollar was in trouble, and just pick up where you went, because as the Fed was raising rates, and being that they were the only central bank raising rates and, you know, threatening or, you know, discussing, now we know for sure they have a plan to start shrinking the balance sheet, and yet the dollar could not rally. That rally was so short-lived that it really caught my eye. So, and to go into deeper in that, you know, usually flattening yield curves are bullish for a currency, because it shows that, you know, money's getting a little bit nervous and you're locking up rates because there's a slowdown coming. So I better rush in and lock up my longer, my needs, my investment needs now. And you know what? We're not seeing it. So I couldn't agree more than I think that's 100% right. But I will pick up with him, because I am a huge fan of Jens Weidmann, as I was of Axel Weber.
Of course.
You know,
of course. And, yeah.
Merkel is an idiot. I have to say that. When she got bested by Sarkozy and they wound up with Draghi rather than Axel Weber, because I think the whole, not only would money be looked at differently, but the Germans would have signed on and been much more aligned with, you know, the ECB policies than they are now. I think there's and Ronnie, you could tell me better than everything I've read, because they're not happy. Because they know what's going on here. And as you say, the rise in real estate prices, you know, I'm only remiss because I've been looking to buy real estate in Germany for a long, long time, but I haven't wanted to chase these valuations. But they've got a severe problem. But give me Jens Weidmann to run the ECB, and the euro would probably go back to 130 or 140.
I think that the Germans, they realize that a strong economy needs a strong currency. And I mean, you just have to have a look at the most prosperous countries. I would say those are all hard currency countries, like Switzerland, for example, like Germany, of course, yeah. While weak currency countries probably most of the time are on the bottom of all those statistics. So, I mean, I read a really interesting interview with Jürgen Stark, who was the chief economist of the ECB. Sure. And in German, this rhyme works. He said, "Stark wie die Mark." Jürgen, strong like the Mark. Yeah. So, and he realized he basically was pretty frustrated because, as the saying goes, everybody thought that the ECB is basically built a bit like the German Bundesbank. And I think within the last couple of years, they realized that it's not that way. And it's definitely not a copy of the old Bundesbank regime. So I would love to see Jens Weidmann succeeding Draghi, but of course it's a highly political issue. And from my point of view, as I always say, I'd love to see a strong euro because a strong currency is actually like a fitness program for the economy. So I always start fighting as soon as economists say, yeah, we need a weak currency to strengthen our economy. That's really economic nonsense.
Speaking of currencies, Jayant, what's happening in India? Can you bring us up to date in terms of the experiment there on going to without cash and going to more like digital-based currency?
Most of that has completely failed, Richard. I think I talked with you about a plane ticket that I bought from an e-commerce company in India about 4 months back. And even after that, even though this happened about 3 to 4 months back, my money is untraceable and I never got the ticket. Indians have almost completely refused to use electronic money because the transaction costs are huge and the money keeps disappearing. So digital experiment has failed in that country. However, businesses continue to fail. And then next week, they are rolling out a new indirect taxation system, which will be completely different from what India has had so far. And this will be a GST VAT kind of system, which will require even small businesses to submit about 40 tax returns every year. And that's a minimum number of returns they have to submit. They have to do inventory management on a daily basis. There are all kinds of regulations that the government is imposing on this wretched old place. And this is, in my view, a train wreck, actually. Next week, what happens will probably make demonetization look like a day in the park. It's going to be a crazy situation in 10 days' time. Every businessman I talk with is extremely scared about the situation.
And do you see any movement perhaps towards a use of a cryptocurrency in India to implement this demonetization?
Certainly a part of the population, the wealthy part of the population, is interested in cryptocurrencies. I was reading somewhere that about 10% of the trade in Bitcoin is because of Indians. However, this is still going to be a very marginal part of India. And the issue with India is that Indians are technically extremely backward. So cryptocurrencies can never become mainstream in that country. It's technologically a very backward country. And the only way they can run that economy, the mainstream of the economy, is by use of physical cash. That's the only way, in my view, that can make that economy continue to run.
And what are your thoughts, Jayant, on cryptocurrencies in general, especially the recent rise in many of the cryptocurrencies in their valuation with respect to the U.S. dollar, for example. Do you see that as a trend? And why is it that they're going up, but gold prices are not going up as much?
Well, one thing that I see consistently is that a lot of people are getting into cryptocurrencies is because cryptocurrencies have risen in the recent past. And that is always a bad way to trade, as most traders would probably agree with. But this is what's happening. My problem with cryptocurrencies is that there is no inherent value in these cryptocurrencies. However, for people in these emerging markets who have no way to move their money outside their own jurisdictions, cryptocurrencies is an extraordinarily good way to move their money out and to preserve the value of what they have in terms of their wealth. Unfortunately, I wish there was a way to back cryptocurrencies with something concrete. And we don't have that backing to any of these cryptocurrencies yet.
And Ronnie, what are your thoughts on that in terms of the trends in cryptocurrencies? Do you see their value or their utility value in terms of moving money around as being very high value relative, say, to gold? Or why the difference in movement between gold prices and cryptocurrencies?
Well, first of all, the asset class is much, much smaller. Just to give you one number, I think the market cap of Bitcoin at the moment is roughly $50 billion, while the total market cap of gold, all gold ever mined, is 7 trillion. So at the moment, I think the market cap of Bitcoin is roughly the same as the Icelandic krona or the quetzales in Guatemala. So it's still fairly small. However, I really like Bitcoin and all the cryptocurrencies for two reasons. First of all, there should be competing currencies, of course. And the second thing is, people actually start questioning and discussing money again. And I think that's really an important discussion, because there are so many people, I would say, from the technical side, you could also say computer nerds, who are really into the technical stuff, and those are coming from one side, and they're coming to the conclusion that Bitcoin and or other cryptocurrencies make sense, and then there are the libertarians, people who question our monetary system, who believe that gold is superior currency or money, and they also arrive at the conclusion that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are very interesting and are probably superior to fiat money. And we should not forget, if you read the white paper by Satoshi Nakamoto, he knows his stuff. He knows Austrian economics. And Bitcoin was actually designed like digital gold, I would say. Because, there's a reason that you're mining for Bitcoin, like you're mining for gold. There's a very good reason that the stock-to-flow ratio of Bitcoin is very similar to the stock-to-flow ratio of gold, and it's actually rising significantly, which is very, very important. So the natural inflation of Bitcoin is falling gradually. Then I think that... going forward, I'm not sure if Bitcoin will be around in 2 or 3 years. Probably yes. I am pretty sure that 99% of all those cryptocurrencies coming up now at the moment and that are rising so quickly, I think 99% of them will be gone in 2 or 3 years. But I'm absolutely certain that the technology behind will be changing whole industries the next couple of years. I think that that's actually what Bill Gates said. Banking is necessary, but banks are not necessary. So I think the whole technology behind will really change the way we do business, and many industry will suffer big time. And I have to say, attending conferences in the cryptocurrency space, it's really great because you're meeting young people who are extremely ambitious. They only see opportunities, they only see innovation. While when you're attending a normal conference with people from the financial industry, everybody is kind of complaining. Everybody is negative because there's too much regulation and stuff, and business is weak, and there's margin compression and so on. So for me, it's really, from an intellectual point of view, it's really stimulating, and I think that's there's a real revolution going on in the crypto space.
Ira, your thoughts on cryptocurrencies having traded the currencies? Yeah, what do you think?
Well, the discussion was great. I agree with both of them, and I'm learning through it. Even though I don't trade it, I watch it, and I'm learning. When Ronnie's talking about the blockchain technology, I try to get myself up to speed every day, because I'll be 64 years old very soon, so I'm old and by these standards, so I have to learn how this works. And I think the point that about Bill Gates, yeah. Banking is necessary, but banks aren't, and I think that's important. And getting to the libertarians, we've talked about this. The thing that scares me about owning cryptocurrencies is, I go back to when the United States outlawed gold. What we learn is that when push comes to shove, nation states, the governments of nation states, do not like competition. So, I already read how the security from the NSA here in the United States to the FBI, to the CIA are learning about this and paying very close attention with it. Because again, we know that governments don't like competition, and it's the reason they don't like gold, because it holds their feet to the fire. And I think Ronnie's exactly right. When there are alternatives, then the Fed doesn't have monopoly power. And I always, I always come back to the statement, and it's bothered me from the moment he said it, when Ben Bernanke, I think it was in 2012, he was the Fed chairman, he says, I understand Bitcoin, but I don't understand gold. I had to get up out of my seat and walk and go for a long walk outside, because it was a terrible statement, but okay, I get it. But then, I'm very comfortable with it in that way too. I like anything that calls away a government monopoly and actually will hold a government to accountability. But when I talk about what I fear, and I had written it down, let me see if I find the note. Under George Bush, there was an executive order. Oh, here it is. I can go right to it. Executive Order 13224, and it had the ability for the executive branch to basically stop the funding of various things. National security. It's the same as why does CFIUS exist? They can hide a lot of things under the guise of national security. So under Executive Order 13224, they have the ability to put an end to anybody using Bitcoin, because if they think that it's funding quote unquote terrorist or nefarious activities, the government has the ability and to force it to stop if they find that it's funding those types of events, which is why the National Security Council is directing the FBI and the CIA into looking into this. So I like watching it. I agree with Ronnie. It's a great intellectual experiment, and it really pushes my mind. But from a trading perspective, I'm very cautious with it, because when I do get up, I fear the government's designs at all times. It's one thing that you learn the older you get.
And your thoughts, Ronnie and Jayant, on this sort of potential financial repression activities that could be imposed by governments on the cryptocurrencies? Final thoughts?
Well, that is my big, certainly another issue that I would have mentioned, that apart from the fact that these cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology is a great technology, and I completely agree with Ronnie that this is going to change the future of many things. But the problem is that firstly, it's not backed by anything physical. And the second issue is what Ira said, and which is that governments don't like competition, and it might prove very easy for the governments to create troubles in the cryptocurrency space.
And Ronnie?
Yeah, of course. If Bitcoin becomes too big, then there will be some interventions, of course. I just read a paper by the IMF called The Macroeconomics of Decashing, and it's basically a guidebook for central bankers or politicians or a manual for politicians to abolish cash by means of some sort of a salami tactics. So I think those things they will all come if Bitcoin becomes too big. And we should not forget that we haven't seen any financialization of the cryptocurrency space. So for institutional investors, for private bankers, whatever, it's at the moment it's totally impossible to invest in Bitcoin. If there should be a future, if there should be ETFs and whatever, then of course really big money will pile into the sector. And at some point I think that governments will realize that this is some sort of competition for their monopoly. But I think, 2 years ago, we already wanted to set up a product on Bitcoin, and we talked to the legislators in Liechtenstein, and they weren't interested at all. Now at this time, they are highly interested because they realize that it's not just a currency for terrorists, crooks, whatever. They realize that it's basically the future, and therefore I think it's kind of funny that also central banks and commercial banks are working on new cryptocurrencies. I'm really I'm curious how they're gonna look like, but I think, as I've said before, it's a very, very interesting experiment. I think the fact that there's ICOs, initial coin offerings, being oversubscribed like 100 times and rising a few thousand percent within a couple of days, this reminds me a bit of the dot-com bubble, with pets.com and all those weird business models. So of course this will become a big bubble, and I'm not sure if we're at the very beginning of this bubble or at the end of the bubble. But what I'm sure of, like in the internet space, I am sure that the technology will of course survive, and that makes me really confident. And I think that, with all those interventions, with all the economic mess and the geopolitical mess that we're in, I think that the ultimate resource, as I think Julian Simon once said, human innovation, it again shows what we are capable of, and that makes me pretty confident for the long term.
Yeah, there's some great points. I agree also with everyone. And the way I see it playing out is governments getting into the cryptocurrency space. As you mentioned, they see some competition in this. So basically turning the fiat currencies into a cryptocurrency of some sort, based on the national currency. But at the same time, allowing private-based cryptocurrencies to exist, as long as they're able to do regulatory compliance to financial system regulations. While they may be outside of the banking system, they would still be within the financial system. So that's a big distinction there. So for example, BitGold and others are have compliance towards OSFI standards in the U.S., OCC standards OSFI standards in Canada, OCC standards in the U.S. and elsewhere. And so there'll be interoperability between these private-based cryptocurrencies and the that are allowed to exist and the government-based currencies. I think it's in the interest of governments as well to go to cryptocurrencies, in particular by central banks, to implement, for example, move towards negative interest rates because of the problems in having physical cash for implementing central bank policy. So I think that's also synchronous as well. As Ronnie mentions, it appears to be a similar fallout to the dot-com boom, where there's a lot of companies out there, and some will go bankrupt, some will be bought out, some will merge. And so there's an initial bubble type of phase now happening, but the technology is likely to stay in the long term. There's lots of applications that can be built on the blockchain technology.
You know, I would, you know, because this is a great discussion, but I would raise one thing that I think about with this, because as I understand the blockchain technology, which is I understand very little of, but Wall Street makes, and Wall Street and therefore London makes a lot of money on the rehypothecation of so many assets, you know, that have collateral base to it. But if I could hold my stocks through blockchain technology in my name and not at the DTC anymore, or the OCC, and Wall Street wouldn't have access to them, that would destroy a big profit center, especially of Wall Street. So I'm, you know, they talk about it like it's a great thing, but I think as more people begin to understand how we could bypass some of the more what I consider nefarious aspects of the global financial world, that they may not become as big a supporters as they think. So, I mean, I don't know that, but it's when you get into the realm of discussing this intellectually and then intellectually to the profit center, that it becomes a detraction for them. So it's just something that I'm thinking about.
Well, that's a great insight, Ira, to end the program show today. Great insights by everybody here today, and just wondering how our listeners can learn more about everyone's work. Ira?
Well, you know, I'm still writing at Notes from Underground and doing these podcasts, which I get great feedback from, and, you know, just the media that I'm out there. So anybody can find me there. So, and I answer most questions coming back. So it provides a great platform for global dialectic and financial concerns. And I'm glad I had the time to spend with Ronnie and Jean, because I learned a lot, and I didn't know of you before, but I do know now, and I will be following both of you. So thank you.
And Ronnie?
Thank you, Ira. A great pleasure meeting you, actually. We've got, of course, the new In Gold with Trust report is out. We published it a couple of days ago. You can download it on ingoldwithtrust.report. We've got our own webpage now for the report. We wrote 170 pages for the extended version, which is like a good weekend or holiday read, but we also got the compact version with 30 pages, and of course all our other research and information about our products and solutions is on our webpage incrementum.li.
Great, Ronnie, and just to mention, we'll be doing a dedicated program show next week, Ronnie and I, on that report and go with
absolutely. I'm looking forward.
And finally, Jayant?
Well, everything that I do, Richard, is on my website, jayantbhandari.com. And my focus for the last 6 to 8 months has been covering what I see as a crisis in India. I have about 15 to 20 articles linked on my website concerning this crisis and as it develops.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Great insight for everyone.
Thank you very
much. Great pleasure. Thank you, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only. and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.